To introduce the second keynote speaker, and that is Professor Cliff Burgess, who'll be speaking. You can see the title of his talk here, The Higgs Boson. What is it, and what does its discovery mean? So, as you can see, Cliff is not in the room. We are going high tech with Skype. So Cliff is one of our premier sort of outreach scientists, and he gives a lot of presentations for outreach and a lot of these to Einstein Plus. And we asked him this year, but as is common with theoretical physicists in the summer, he is actually traveling. And he's actually traveling in Europe. And for a couple of months, he is actually staying at CERN, basically at Ground Zero, to work with people there and experimentalists. But this week, where he is just at the moment, is in the Italian city of Trieste. As you can see, the ICTP, International Center for Theoretical Physics, collaborating there. But he has recently been at CERN and will be returning there, I believe, shortly. So he's very well connected in terms of knowing the absolute latest that is going on. So Cliff is a professor at McMaster University in Hamilton, a local university. He is also an associate faculty member here at Perimeter Institute. He, as well as doing a lot of outreach, has a very sort of broad range of interest in theoretical physics, spanning everything from cosmology, the CMB, many other topics in cosmology, to particle physics. But obviously today he's going to talk about particle physics. So without further ado, I am going to hand it over to Cliff, who I guess we'll see in the top right corner and see his slides as well. So please give him a good virtual round of applause to start.
Thank you. Thank you, Damien. And thanks for that, giving me the chance to talk, even though I'm on sabbatical. I'm actually going to be at CERN for the whole year, so it's kind of nice to get a chance to do this anyway. Because talking to the teachers, I have to say, is that that's the best of all these public talks, because teachers make such an impact on students, obviously. But you talk to any scientist, and they all know a teacher that really influenced them in the past. So it's great to talk to you. So I'm just turning the timer on here. Okay, my mandate is to talk about the Higgs boson, which was discovered 2 years ago. And so by telling you that, I'm telling you that I'm answering the what is it question, I guess, partly, that there was a particle discovered and it's looking really like it is the Higgs boson. And so I want to kind of go over what it is and what it's telling us. And so let me show you how I want to do that. So the first part of the talk, I want to talk about the Large Hadron Collider. And kind of, you remember probably that it turned on, I guess it was five or six years ago, and then almost immediately they broke it. And I want to tell you that story because the breaking of it has shaped how they are it's actually turned off right now, but it's going to be turned on again in the fall, and then they'll be running the experiments again in the beginning of next year. And that timing is partly driven by how they broke it. And then I want to tell you about what they're looking for and the theoretical background for that, which is the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And then I want to talk about the Higgs discovery itself. And so what is it they saw, and what's the evidence for that being the Higgs particle that the previous section will have told you why they were looking for the Higgs particle. And then that'll be it. So let's start off with the LHC. So there's two parts. The first part is what is it, and then the second part is how did they break it. So this is the Geneva area. So in the middle there, the big ring is the LHC, which you can't see, of course. It's not really a big ring that you can see from space, but it's underground. But you kind of see the setting for it, which is really gorgeous. So that just above the ring is Lake Geneva. There's a little white smudge at the end of Lake Geneva, which is the Jet d'Eau, which is that fountain in Geneva proper. And then behind you see the Alps, and the one in the middle there is Mont Blanc. It's really a spectacular place. And it gives you an idea of the scale of the LHC. It's 27 kilometers in circumference. And CERN, the lab, is kind of on that red ring has a whole bunch of small red rings on it. And the one that's kind of to the far right is not it, but the one above it, so the kind of to the top right is kind of where the lab would be, as you'll see in the slide or two. So this kind of gives you a 3D picture now looking down the valley. The Alps would be to your left in this picture, and you see how it's really underground, that you don't see it from space because it's underground. And there's a bunch of there's a ring, but there's a bunch of detectors which are at the bottom of all these shafts coming down from the top of the ground. And the ones I'm going to talk about the most are ATLAS and CMS, which are these the two main all-purpose detectors. And the little ring called SPS that's off to the side there is an older accelerator they use to kind of start off the process of accelerating particles, which they then inject into the LHC, and then they use them in the experiments. So what happens is that you have protons, you know, hydrogen nuclei, and they're running in both directions in the ring, so they're counter-rotating, and then they're brought together to collide where these detectors are. And the energy that they have in each beam, for each beam of protons, is 7 TeV, where the way to think about TeV, a tera electron volt, is that 940 million electron volts is what you get from the rest mass of a proton. So a TeV is about 1,000 times the rest mass of a proton turned to energy. And then 7 times that is what each of these things has. So that tells you that these are very relativistic particles, that their energy is much, much higher. Their kinetic energy is much, much higher than the energy in their rest mass. So here's the beautiful thing itself and the detector next to it. And so this is actually a complete fake. This is actually a couple of weeks ago I went to visit the, because it's shut down, you can visit things, and it's actually very hard to visit the accelerator itself, but it's easier to visit the detectors. And one of the detectors has a huge life-size poster of what it looks like inside the accelerator. And so I stood in front of the poster and I cropped the edges so it looks like I'm actually in the accelerator, but it's pretty good, I think. So here's a cross section of the magnet. What I should have said is that big blue thing is a magnet. That's the way to get these protons to go in a circle is they have these magnets, and the blue one is one of them. And then if you took a cross section through it, this is what it would look like. And the two little gold tubes are where the beams are. So when one of them, the protons are going, say, into the screen, and the other one, the protons are coming out of the screen. And then all the other stuff around it is stuff to do with the making the magnetic fields. And the two little tubes where the protons are in are all evacuated, so there's no air in there for the protons to hit. And then this is kind of a graphic that shows you that those two beams are brought together periodically where the detectors are, and so they don't hit each other most of the time in the ring, but every once in a while, they're not only are they brought together, but they're narrowed down so that it's much more likely for the protons to collide once their beams are brought together. So that's the machine. And so now here's the lab. This picture is an aerial photograph of CERN, the lab. And the French-Swiss border kind of runs horizontally through it about halfway up. And then it runs along the left-hand fence of CERN until it gets up to that traffic circle at the top. And so the thing I want you to focus on is to the bottom, midway down to the right, there's kind of a ballish-like thing, which is there. That's the center. That's kind of one of the outreach centers at CERN. And just to the right of it is a bunch of buildings, which you can see in the picture to the left, which I took a couple of months ago, standing on the road where the arrows are pointing to, looking past that round thing to the buildings behind it. And the thing with all the pictures on it is the ATLAS experimental building. And so right below that is the ATLAS detector, and a picture of the detector is drawn on the side of the building there for you. And so that's kind of one of the famous landmarks at CERN is that round building. When they did Angels and Demons, they took a picture in front of it. That's the picture of the Angels and Demons people. And I show you that because I want to compare the first few scenes in Angels and Demons took place at CERN, and were filmed at CERN, and I want to compare what they filmed to what it actually looks like. Because they actually did some shots right in the ATLAS detector. Starting with this one, they zoom right down this big shaft heading down from the ground to the detector, and this is a picture in the movie, and this is a picture I took a couple years ago. You can't take these pictures anymore because they've now made it so you can't look at the shaft. It's harder to get access to it. But what you're missing here is you're looking down here, and that blue thing in the bottom is the detector. And what you can't see from this is the scale of the whole thing. That you should think of this shaft that we're looking down as being like the Peace Tower of the Parliament Buildings. And then that blue thing is like the east block of the Parliament Buildings, like it's a four-story building, essentially. And that kind of gives you an idea of the size of the thing we're talking about. So the detector is like the body of the Peace Tower, the Parliament Buildings, and then the shaft is like the Peace Tower with the ground at the top. And so in the movie, you went right from, they zoomed down that shaft, they went by the detector, and then they went into the control room here, which had a glass wall separating it from the detector in the background, as you can see in the picture. And you knew it's a control room because it's full of physicists, and you knew it was physicists because they're all bald and they're wearing lab coats. And so that's kind of Hollywood for you, because in real life the control room is nowhere near the detector because it's dangerous to be near the detector when it's running. It's full of radiation, so it's all the control rooms are on the ground. And so this is the picture I took a couple months ago where. This is the Atlas control room, and they've actually renovated it so that now one whole wall is plastic, and the public can stand behind the wall and watch them work, which I think must be very annoying if you're in this first desk here. And so I took this from the public side of the wall. There's a bit of a glare there you're seeing because there's some plastic. It's the picture's being taken through, but they've really made it publicly accessible in an interesting, unusual way. So then in the movie, they collide the particles and it's easy to see them. They make antimatter, which is actually true. They make a lot of antimatter, but it's easy to see them because they glow in the dark in the movie. Of course, that's not true either, that they're actually hard to see because they're invisible, but you need these massive detectors to see them. So these are the detectors. So this is the one on the left is Atlas, and the one on the right is CMS, and this is when they were being assembled. So they actually had been taken apart here. And so CMS on the right, you can see the tube in the middle, which is where the beam goes. And what they do is they move this whole thing together so that the thing on the left nests into the thing on the right when it's actually running. And in Atlas, what's happened is that those big, on the picture on the left, the big orange stripy things are magnets. And then there's a big end cap that goes on the end of the whole thing. And right in the middle of that structure with the scaffolding is where the beam would go. You can't see it now because when they took this picture, the beam line wasn't there, but that's where it is now. So it's hard to see these particles, and it's partly because they're invisible, but there's also more to it, why it's hard. So here's a cutaway view of the Atlas detector, and it's got a lot of parts to it, and the reason it's got a lot of parts is that there's two things that you should know about these colliders, is that the way you hear about collisions in accelerators is often people talk about it as being like you're colliding two cars and you look at the parts that are coming out and you can from that figure out how the car is built. And that's kind of suggestive but not quite right, because what really happens is that when you collide particles together at energies that are much, much higher than the rest mass of the particles, what comes out is actually not necessarily stuff that was in the particles to start with. It's you're producing particles and their antiparticles from nothing, or from electromagnetic radiation mostly, all the time. And so half the things that come out are antiparticles, and half the things that come out are particles, and none of them were in the particles that you start off with in the original collision. So the good news is the good news is you don't have to design the things you accelerate very carefully to get a specific kind of particle out. But the bad news is that you're not necessarily learning a lot. By looking at what comes out, you're not necessarily seeing what the things that you collided were made out of. That's one part of the bad news. The other part of the bad news is that all these new particles you make are mostly unstable, and so they decay, and they decay with a lifetime of 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So even moving at the speed of light, they're lucky to cross a nucleus before they decay. So what you see coming out of these collisions is not the new particles, because they've decayed already. They decayed into run-of-the-mill ordinary particles like electrons or protons or pions or something. And so what these detectors are being designed to do is to distinguish what kind of ordinary particles came out. So they have to measure their energy and measure their direction and measure which kind of particle it was, so that you can then work backwards and say, so now what did I have to produce a particle like this or this particular combination of particles? And so these various colors in the detector are things that are made of different materials, and they're made of different materials because different particles interact differently with different kinds of materials. And so in that way, by comparing the way particles interact with the different parts of the detector, they can tell what kind of particle it was. So for example, the thing in the very middle part, the yellow and kind of red thing right near the beam, is designed so that anything with electric charge will make a little track. And so you can actually physically see the direction it goes as long as it has a charge, because it's ionizing the material that part of it's made out of. And then the green thing is designed so that if something has a charge, it'll like to deposit. It's made of heavy atoms, and so that a charged particle will like to collide with it and lose energy, and an electron will typically lose all of its energy and just stop in the green area. something like a proton that's charged, that's heavier, will actually go right through the green area, lose some energy, but then it'll continue into the orange area. So I'll get to protons in a second. But the orange area will see things that are heavier than electrons. Before I talk about the protons, something like a photon, which is not charged, you would not see in the middle of the detector because it doesn't have a charge, but you would see it in this green part of the detector because a photon would still lose energy in the material that the green part is made out of, and it would stop there much like an electron would. A proton is like an electron but heavier, and it also interacts through the strong interactions, which the electrons don't. So a proton actually punches right through the green area. You see it in the middle part because it's got a charge. You see it go right through the green area, and it goes into the orange area and then typically stops there. So the orange area is kind of made of a more dense thing, so it can stop the heavier things. Neutrons are like protons, except they don't have a charge. So you see them everywhere you saw a proton, except in the middle, because you don't have a charge. And then the muon is like an electron, as you'll see, but a heavier electron. So it does not take part in the strong interactions, but it does interact otherwise like an electron. And so it goes through, does everything electron does. Because it's heavier, it goes into the orange area. But because it's not interacting as strongly as a proton, because it doesn't take part in the strong interactions, it goes right through and it hits the blue areas. And so it actually goes right through the blue areas and typically escapes. That's why it's dangerous to be down there when it's running. But the blue things kind of tell you that something has gone through with a certain amount of energy. And so there's a particle called a neutrino, which doesn't show up anywhere. And that makes it kind of tricky. So you want to make sure the way you tell a neutrino has been there is that you look at everything else that you could see. And if it all came out one side of the detector, you know that momentum conservation meant something else went out to the other side of the detector that you didn't see. Neutrinos are kind of notoriously hard to see because they can go through light years of lead and not hit anything. So right now, if you make a little circle with your finger and your thumb, that's about a square centimeter. Every square centimeter, every second, something like 10 billion neutrinos pass through that, being sent to us from the sun, coming from the nuclear interactions at the center of the sun. And the fact that we are oblivious to that is a sign that's how weakly they interact. And so they're very hard to see, but we know that they're there because you can see them if you have enough stuff for them to interact with. So the message is that these detectors are kind of complicated and they're hermetically surrounding the collision point because you want to catch everything that you can, and you want to be able to infer the particles you didn't see, so that you can figure out what produced the particles that came out. So here's an example of what the detector would see. So there was a reaction that took place and it had two electrons and two muons in it. And so I guess the black lines here would be the electrons. So they get partway out to the grid and then they stop. And then these long ones that go out to these green slabs. The green slabs were what was blue in the previous picture. And you see that there's something has gone out and it's actually then activating all these, what they call the muon detectors on the outside of the experiment. So that's the accelerator. That's the detectors. And so now how do they break it? So the joke I would normally tell here is that angels and demons got a lot of things right, but one of the worst things they got wrong was that in the movie when they turned it on, it worked. So what happened in real life was they turned it on and it worked for about a week and then they broke it. So what happened was they broke it in this. So here's this picture again, and you see Lake Geneva at the top and here's the ring again. And then the red area at the bottom is where the breakage took place. And so it's right below the picture is the Jura Mountains. And so there's a lot of I don't know if that's significant for the breakage, but it's kind of the place where if they're going to have trouble, that's where they have it. And so there's all these magnets, remember, that are in this thousands of magnets that are making it possible for these protons to go in a circle. And the problem came at the join between these two magnets, between pairs of magnets. So here's a place where two of these magnets are connected to each other. And you see that there's lots of things to connect. And in particular, deep inside there is a copper bus bar. And so here's the top part of this picture is the copper bus bar. And then the bottom two pictures are x-rays of the welds that were done to connect these copper bus bars. And you see that there were places inside the bus bar in retrospect that were not welded very well. And that was the source of the problem, it turned out. And so what was going on there, what the copper bus bar is that's actually, normally you make wires out of copper because it's a good conductor, but on the LHC, copper is actually used as the insulator that you wrap the wires with. because the actual wires in these magnets are superconducting wires. They're at liquid helium temperatures because they, so it's like, I think it's less than 2 degrees, 2 or 3 degrees Kelvin. And the whole 27 kilometer ring is that cold. And so these superconducting magnets, wires, they carry a current, and that's where the magnetic field comes from, but they don't have any resistance because they're superconducting. And so because of that, ordinary copper, it, by comparison, is like a resistor. And so they wrap the superconducting wire, or they put it next to the copper busbar, so the copper is acting like the is the analog of the rubber wiring you would have put around an ordinary copper wire. And the reason they use copper is that, as you know, as long as the thing is superconducting, you don't care what you wrap the superconducting wire with. But if it ever happens that for some reason your magnet warms up above 3 degrees Kelvin, which happens from time to time, it's called a quench when that happens, it stops superconducting. And so then what happens is that then the current wants to go somewhere, and it's a lot of current, and it's all of a sudden it's resisting, and so it's producing a lot of energy because of the resistance. And so you want to have it go into some place which is not going to be too dangerous, and that goes into the copper busbar, and that's that carries the current off to some place where it's not going to damage anything. And so the idea is the red thing in the middle here, the vertical red thing, is supposed to be one of these welds. And so this all works as long as the copper busbars are welded nicely to each other. But if somebody doesn't do a good job welding those copper busbars to each other, then everything's fine as long as the things are superconducting. And that's what happened for the first week or so. But once you get a couple of quenches where a couple of magnets have been warmed up to the point where they're no longer superconducting, then what happens is that the current tries to go into the copper, and then it can't go into the next copper because the weld was so bad, and so then it goes somewhere else and it damages everything. And so that's what happened, is that it actually physically picks up these magnets which are screwed into the concrete, picks them up, moves them over, and puts them down again, and so it does an enormous amount of damage, and then that picks up, the magnets are all tied to each other, so the next one gets picked up, and the next one gets picked up, and so that's the top picture is a picture of some of the damage that was done. And I'm told this was actually not a very, there was a lot more damage. This makes it look better than it was. And the bottom pictures here are showing you what it looks like if you look down that vacuum tube where the protons go, and it's supposed to look pink when it's copper, but all the gray stuff is all the crap that went down the vacuum when they started to move the magnets around. And so not only do you have problems where you physically move the magnets, but you've also destroyed your vacuum system by putting a whole bunch of dirt down it. So it was really kind of a big mess. It's hard to get pictures of this damage because if you Google damage at the LHC, you get all these websites about how black holes are going to destroy the Earth. So they've been fixing things. The main message is they haven't fixed everything because in order to fix it, they have to warm it up again from 3 degrees Kelvin to room temperature. And they do that one octant at a time. And then they have to fix all the magnets, and there's thousands of magnets, and they have to cool them all down again, and they have to retrain all the magnets so that they don't, that they're kind of stable once they're back at 3 degrees Kelvin. So it's a long process. And so what they did is they figured out where the problems were, and they fixed those places that were actually damaged or were likely to break down again. And there are some parts of it that they didn't fix. So what they've done because of that is they figured they didn't have to fix everything as long as it didn't run at the full energy that they had designed it to run at. And so you remember they were designed to have, each beam was designed to have 7 TeV in energy. So when you collide them together head on, there's a total of 14 TeV of energy available in the collision. So what they did instead was they ran it at half that since 2009. So they did a first preliminary fix. They ran it at 7 TeV, so that was really 3.5 TeV in each beam colliding for a while. And just before they shut it down again about a year ago, they raised that to 4 TeV against 4 TeV, so there's a total of 8 available in the collision. And then they did that because they were pretty sure they were going to be able to find the Higgs boson or show that it wasn't there in that amount of time. And then what they did is that they shut it all down, and then they warmed everything up and they fixed it all. And so and in the meantime, the detectors also took the advantage to fix things and to upgrade some equipment. And so right now, if you visit these detectors, a lot of the parts are on the ground because they're fixing them, but they're all designed, their schedule is they're going to have it all put back together by September so that they can start putting beam through the LHC again by late September. And then the accelerator physicists will play with it for most of the fall to slowly raise the energy to the full 14 TeV. And then what they'll do is in January or February or the spring sometime next year, they'll start running again, but now at the full design energy. So the main thing is that because they broke it, they have been running, but not at the full energy available. And it turns out that's important, because for most of the things you look for, except for the Higgs particle, there's no substitute for having the highest energy possible. So there's some things that they can't have, they might have seen, but they wouldn't have seen because they were not running at the full energy. But the Higgs was not one of those. So they had a good run. It was the highest energies ever available in accelerators before, but it wasn't as high as they had hoped to have when they designed it. So that's the accelerator. That's how they broke it. And so now, why were they thinking that the Higgs should be there, and why were they so confident that they could find it or rule it out? So they were confident because the theory side of the story was actually done in the late 60s and early 70s. And the very successful theory called the Standard Model, which describes essentially everything that's been seen in particle physics, with a couple exceptions that I'll come to at the end. But it was the time between the late 60s and now essentially has been spent by people trying to test the Standard Model and find places where it fails. And for the most part, there haven't been places where it fails. So the picture is this continuation of what's gone on throughout history, where we're explaining bigger things in terms of smaller things. And it's not true that sometimes you hear that this is reductionism, and so this is so 20th century and we don't do this anymore. And that's actually, I would say, a straw man. People say correctly that, you know, that if you're trying to understand, say, how sheep move, a stupid way to do that is to think about what the corks are doing inside the sheep. That's true. I think that it's when I used to teach introductory astronomy, it's the same kind of thing. If you're trying to describe students, describing what their atoms are doing is really not going to tell you much at all either. It is true that you can understand much of what's going on in any system in terms of the things that are important at the scales that you're interested in. So if you want to describe people, then people can be understood on their own terms, and you don't need to know what their atoms are doing necessarily. But it is also true that part of the description of what's going on, or part of the boundaries of your description of what's going on when you're describing people, or you're describing cells, or you're describing animals, is set by the things that they're made out of. So if you're describing cars, you can describe traffic flow without understanding how a car works. But an important part of that description will be the limitations of a car. How fast can it go? And so some of the properties of a car are relevant to understanding traffic flow. It's not the main thing for describing traffic flow, but it's one of the things that you need to know for the description. And so in the same spirit, when we're trying to describe things at smaller and smaller scales, we're not trying to describe everything. We're trying to describe the things from which the larger things are built. And so in that way, you identify the fundamental laws, but the fundamental laws have complex solutions on larger scales, which can be understood on their own terms. So in this historical picture, we've gone down from everyday sizes to cell sizes to atomic sizes to nuclear sizes. And then inside the nucleus, we found protons and neutrons. Inside those, we found quarks. And the questions that you're asking at the LHC are, what's inside the quarks? Or is there anything inside the quarks? And what are the fundamental laws that are going on at distances that are smaller than the distances that have been accessed anywhere before? So the theory that seems to work so far is made by these three people in the 60s. So the guy on the left is Sheldon Glashow, and he made his contribution in the early 60s. And then the two on the right, Abdus-Salam and Steven Weinberg, made their contribution in the late 60s, where they kind of fixed something which was hard to understand in the version that Glashow had made. So the three of them are kind of jointly given credit for the discovery of the Standard Model, and they won a Nobel Prize for it in 1979. And so in their picture, everything is made out of these particles. So the things that are in the first three columns are what matter is made out of. And all of everyday matter is really made of only the first column. So the two first rows are the quarks. Those are the things that take part in the strong interactions. And then the bottom two rows are the things that don't take part in the strong interactions, which are called leptons. And everything in the first column is what everyday matter is made out of. So a proton is two up quarks and a down quark, and a neutron is two down quarks and an up quark, and an electron is electron, and most things are made out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And the neutrino in that column is one of these things that comes from the sun, which is very, very difficult to detect, but we know that it's there. Then one of the things that no one understands but seems to be true is that you know, whoever made nature, Mother Nature, turns out to be a bureaucrat. So everything's in triplicate. So there's the first column that we see, and there's two copies of everything. And so the second column and third column are essentially identical to the first column, except they have more mass. And no one knows why that's true. And then the red column is the particles that mediate forces. So their only difference from the first three columns are that they satisfy Bose statistics, so that they're like photons, and that you love to have many of them in the same state. Whereas the fermions, you hate to have more than one in one state. And so because the bosons like to be in the same state, you can make fields out of them, and those are what we think of as forces. And so it turns out that there's a variety. The photon is what we understand is responsible for the electromagnetic forces. The Z and W particles are responsible for the weak forces, which are the things that mediate radioactive decays. And the gluons, of which there are eight, mediate the strong interactions. So they're the things that bind together quarks into a proton and a neutron, and protons and neutrons together into a nucleus. And so until 2 years ago, that was the complete list of particles that had been ever found in accelerators. And the interactions amongst them was, as described by the Standard Model, really captured everything that had been measured in all accelerators until 2 years ago. But the Standard Model was not made of just these particles. There was one more particle that the Standard Model had to have, and that was the Higgs boson. And so that was the one that everybody was looking for. And the next few slides will be why people were so sure that there was another particle there, and why the Standard Model had to have this new particle. So to set up the reason for the Higgs particle, there's an experimental fact that you need to know, or actually several of them. So one of them is all these fermions, all the particles that make up matter, like the quarks and the leptons, and the, you know, like the electron, come in with two spins, it turns out. And one way of thinking about the spins, typically they're thought of as being handedness. They're either right-handed or left-handed. And the way you think about that is you imagine your thumb pointing in the direction the particle's moving, and then your fingers moving in the direction of the way the particle's spinning. And then if you compare your left hand to your right hand, if your fingers are spinning the same way, your thumbs are pointing the opposite way. And so if their thumbs are pointing in the same way, so the particles are moving the same direction, your two hands would be rotating in opposite directions. And so they're describing the two ways that something can spin around the direction of motion. So those are called left-handed and right-handed, those two ways of spinning. And you're kind of familiar with that from, in a special case of photons. Photons also have two spins, and those are the polarizations of light that is, the Polaroid glasses, for instance, filter out one polarization, and that's how they reduce the glare. Now, the fact that you need to know is that the weak interactions, which involve these W and Z particles, one of the interactions is pictured here. So this picture is of a muon decaying. So the muon comes, think of time moving from left to right. And so the muon moves along, and it turns into a muon neutrino, plus a W particle, which then itself decays into an electron and an anti-electron neutrino. Now, it turns out that if you ask what was the spin of these of the muon and the electron and the muon neutrino and the electron neutrino, it's always left-handed. So there were two spins available, but it seems like the weak interactions that involve the W particle only involve the left-handed pieces of particles. That just was something which emerged from experiments over the 40s and the 50s. So that's interesting, but what makes it weird is, if you think about the way we're describing spin, it's kind of ambiguous. I said that the left-handed, say, was defined by how things spin relative to the direction of your motion, but I can change the direction of your motion if I kind of move past you. So if I imagine measuring assigning the spin of some particle that's moving by me, and then you move by me even faster than that particle is moving, then as far as you're concerned, the spin is going to be the same, but the direction of motion is going to be actually in the other direction because you're moving faster than that particle was. So you would actually say that particle has the opposite spin as I would say. If I thought it was left-handed, you'd say it's right-handed. So that makes it sound like it should actually be ambiguous whether a particle is left-handed or right-handed, unless it's moving at the speed of light, because if it's moving at the speed of light, nobody can catch it, everybody agrees in what direction it's moving. So it would only make sense that things a law that distinguishes left-handedness from right-handedness should only make sense for massless particles which move at the speed of light. So the paradox seemed to be that if you take part in the weak interactions, you need to care whether you're left-handed or right-handed. But on the other hand, you can only care if you're left-handed or right-handed if you're moving at the speed of light, and so you don't have a mass. But we know that electrons and muons take part in the weak interactions because the muon decays to an electron, and neither the muon nor the electron moves at the speed of light. So that was kind of the paradox that was left after Glashow had finished making his part of the model. And the question was, how do you reconcile these facts of the weak interaction with the fact that particles we know about seem to not move at the speed of light? So let me just, I lost my clock here. I'll make sure that I know what time it is. All right. So what to do? So what to do is what's called the Higgs mechanism. And this is why the Higgs boson is supposed to be there. So it was invented, like many things, first by someone, not Higgs, but by Broughton and Englert. So who are the two in the middle of the top row. And then shortly afterwards by Higgs, independently. But it's called the Higgs mechanism because Higgs gave a really good talk about it. And so people really understood. He had a very simple way of explaining what was going on. And people really got it when he explained it. And so people said, oh, yeah, that thing that Higgs talked about, that Higgs mechanism. And so the three of them really rightly get credit for it. In fact, there's the other four here also independently came up with the idea slightly later. And they have a kind of marginally less argument for the Nobel Prize because they were less clear that there had to be a particle involved. But there were a lot of people here who could have gotten a Nobel Prize for this. But the three, two in the end got it, Higgs and Englert, who's in the middle of the top row. Turns out that Braut had died in the meantime, and you can't get the Nobel Prize posthumously. So they came up with a mechanism that kind of reconciled this problem. And their observation was that everything I've told you before is true. Things should be moving at the speed of light if that's all there was. But they made the observation that the vacuum itself can have physical properties, and the previous discussion kind of ignored that. And if we had been moving, if we'd been living in water, we might have some properties that we could have expected to have in air, but we mightn't expect those properties to be the same if we look at how things behave in water. So if the vacuum, if we're kind of immersed in the vacuum, and the vacuum has physical properties, then it could be that the properties that we see in particles, like their mass, is not the same as they would have had if they had been pristinely not in the vacuum. And so the Higgs mechanism idea is to say that the vacuum has physical properties, and it's our interactions with those properties that give us that modify the properties of the particles we see, because we never see particles not in the vacuum. And so you can imagine, if you compare how different kinds of particles move through water, that they, given us the same force, they could move more or less efficiently depending on the resistance they had. And that's kind of like what's going on when particles move through the vacuum, but not quite, because what's deceptive about that kind of analogy is that it makes it sound like it's drag or that there's friction involved and that things should stop. That would be what Aristotle would say the vacuum was like. But really, the way to think about the vacuum giving a particle a mass is that the vacuum can interact with you. The vacuum has physical properties that you can interact with, and there will be, in general, an energy of interaction associated with that. But then Einstein tells us that mass and energy are the same thing. So if there's an energy of interaction, that will look like a mass if you take that energy and divide it by c squared. So what we mean by mass is we have a particle in front of us, and the energy it carries when it's not moving is what we call its rest mass. And if only we could do that without having the vacuum there, we would see that it was massless. But because it's there with the vacuum next to it and it's interacting with the vacuum, it has an energy that we can't see is associated with that interaction with the vacuum, but it is. That's their hypothesis. Sounds kind of, you know, very off the wall. Why would you believe this kind of thing? But people were desperate to try and reconcile this problem in the 60s, and this was the way that they wanted to approach it. And the way you test that is that if the vacuum is really physically there, then you should whack it and let it vibrate. Something, you know, the fact that you've perturbed the vacuum will have to move through space at some speed because nothing can go faster than light. So there have to be waves in the vacuum. And those waves, if you can excite them, will be the evidence that you're living in an environment. In the same way that if you'd been in water, the way you could really convince yourself that the water was there is to watch it vibrate, because then that's something that was associated with the medium itself and not something moving through the medium. And so the Higgs particle is that. It's a wave in the vacuum. If the vacuum has got physical properties, then it should be true that when you disturb it, there will be waves. And then a Higgs particle is to that wave the same way that a photon is to an electromagnetic wave. It's the quantum of energy that that wave carries. And so that's why people believe that the Higgs particle had to be there. The Higgs field should be there, giving the vacuum properties and interacting with particles to give them mass. But if it was really true that that was right, then consistency required there to be a wave that would be supported by the vacuum, and that would be that would look like, to us, like a particle, and you should look for it. So that model works really well, it turns out. So this slide is just supposed to show you that it's really quantitatively working well, that this is a particular class of things that are predicted by the model. It's the cross-section for collisions. If you take electrons and positrons and collide them and look at them producing various kinds of particles. So most of the black curve is describing the prediction for electrons and positrons colliding and giving you hadrons, so things involving quarks and gluons in the final state, and where you don't care what kind of a quark and gluon you get, you just add it all up. And you see that there's a kind of an interesting curve that was predicted, and all the various dots are various experiments that measured it. The ones on the resonance in the middle part, labeled by the Z, that energy is the mass of the Z boson. And those experiments were done at LEP, the Large Electron Positron Machine, and that was the previous accelerator that was in the same tunnel that the LHC now is in. And then the to the right, you see there's a blue line, which is the case for electron positrons going to W plus, W minus pairs. It only happens to the right because you have to have at least enough energy to produce a W particle, and you see that that also works very well. And so there's a lot of very detailed predictions which have been verified in great detail. And the reason that that's significant for the Higgs story is that the predictions were sufficiently precise that their predictions cared about what the mass of the Higgs was and its what its properties were. And this plot here is showing you what the predictions were for. It turns out in the standard model, the W boson mass is something where you get to calculate. It's not a parameter you get to choose. It's something which is an output of the theory. And this graph is showing you how it depends on the Higgs mass. So the Higgs mass is on the vertical scale, on a logarithmic scale. So 10 to the 2 is 100 GeV. Remember, a GeV is about a proton mass. So this would be 100 times the proton mass, and then up to 1,000. And across the bottom is the mass of the W boson in a regular scale, not logarithmic, in the ballpark of 80 GeV. And the yellow stripe is what was been measured as the W boson mass. And then the tilted blue stripe is the prediction in the standard model for what the Higgs boson mass, what the W boson mass is as a function of the unknown Higgs boson mass. And you see that the heavier the Higgs boson is, the lighter the W boson is. But agreement with experiment forces you to be down at the bottom of the graph, which is where the Higgs boson is fairly light. So people weren't quite sure, due to the success of the standard model, that the Higgs boson had to be found. It hadn't been seen, but the reason it hadn't been seen was not that there was not enough energy to produce it, because 100 GeV is not actually that heavy. That's not much heavier than the Z boson, which is 90 GeV, which has been produced since the early 80s. The problem with the Higgs boson was that it was hard to see once you did produce it. And so the trick was, that's kind of why in the LHC they knew that they didn't need more energy to produce the Higgs particle. They had to be clever about finding the things it decayed into, if it was there. So that sounds wonderful. Why do we not believe this? The standard model is the whole story. There's at least two reasons. One of them is, there's a story to do with neutrinos. I told you that neutrinos are coming from the sun, but there were three kinds of neutrinos, because remember, everything's in triplicate in the standard model. And it was believed, and actually it's true in the standard model, that only one of the three kinds of neutrinos should be coming from the sun, because the nuclear reactions in the sun all involve the first column. They take protons into neutrons, which involves the up and down quarks, and they should only be producing, it turns out, the electron neutrino. But a long series of experimental tests since the 60s, culminating in the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in the 90s, shows us that actually all three neutrinos are coming from the sun, and so that there's something wrong with the standard model, because the standard model would say it's impossible that we can be getting the other two neutrinos from the sun. So that's one thing we know is wrong with the standard model. There's other things with neutrinos that are to do with other ways of seeing neutrinos that are also wrong in the standard model. But there's a class of things in the standard model about neutrinos that the standard model does not get right. The second thing that it does not get right is the picture of what cosmology sees. So in cosmology, since the 1990s, we've been able to survey what's in the universe independent of whether you can see it. And the amazing thing there is that 95% of what's out there is stuff that we're not seeing. And there's two kinds of that stuff. And so either that's two kinds of new particles, which the standard model would say is not there, or somehow gravity is different than you're expecting it to be, but that's also, for the purposes of cosmology, the standard model is the standard model plus general relativity. Something is missing in that picture of standard model plus general relativity, no matter how you slice that. And so everything in the standard model would be the red wedge, the normal matter, and all the rest of that is not in the standard model. And so somehow there's something missing there too. So far so good. Model works really well, except for these two places. And the Higgs was predicted to be there, but it hadn't been found until it's going to turn out quite recently. So what's the story about what they found? What do they actually see, and what's the evidence that they're seeing the Higgs particle? So first thing is, how do you look for the Higgs particle? And then the next thing will be, what do they actually see? And then the last thing will be, what's it telling us about what we should be expecting to see when they turn this thing on, the LHC on again next spring? So here's an example of a reaction where this is a kind of an electronic output. This cylindrical blue thing is supposed to be the detector, like something like Atlas. This is a CMS, this particular one. So I don't know what you last heard. CMS, okay. Well, you missed the really good joke. Ah, I forget it. So you remember how I was telling you about the dwarves in the canoe? So here's the upshot. The upshot was that this is a picture of something going into two photons. And it turns out that this is the Higgs going to two photons. And so the next few slides will be, how did they know? So let me turn my timer on here again. There we go. Okay, so it turns out the Higgs does go to two photons. It decays into two photons. But lots of things give you two photons in the Large Hadron Collider. It's a needle in the haystack. You've got protons colliding with protons. There's lots of charged things, lots of photons flying around. It's like looking for two photons in the sun. There's lots of photons there. So how do you tell if you see two photons that they came from a Higgs? So what you do is, if you see two photons, what you do is you go to the rest. You kind of imagine imagine moving to a frame for which the two photons are actually moving away from each other in equal and opposite directions. So they're back to back. And the reason you do that is that if those two photons came from the decay of a particle, like the Higgs particle, in that frame, that would be the rest frame of the particle that was decaying. So that means that before the decay, you just had the particle sitting there at rest, and the only energy that was available was the mass of that particle. After the decay, you've got two photons that are moving away from each other back to back. And so momentum conservation says they have the same momentum, so they have to have the same energy. So their energy must be half the mass of the particle. So if you add up the two energies, that will be the mass of the particle that decayed, and it'll always be the same mass. So what you do is you take these two photons and you calculate what their energy would have added up to if you had been moving in such a way that they had been moving in opposite directions from each other. And that's what this plot is showing you. This plot is showing you the bottom is what it's called M gamma gamma, but that's what that means is that's the energy that these two photons would have had if you had been moving in such a way as to make them move in opposite directions. And then you added up their energies in that frame. And then the vertical axis is the number of events with photons with that particular value of M gamma gamma. And you see, you get this is actually a measurement. So they get a distribution of things. Yeah, that's what that all the little dots are. And the line is a histogram of the kind of the number of events they've had. And if the Higgs had a mass of 130 GeV. All of the ones that are coming, all of the pairs of photons coming from a Higgs decay would all be sitting in this plot at the same place at 130. So the little red thing at the bottom of this graph is what you would have expected to find from Higgs decays if the Higgs had a mass of 130 GeV. And you can see just a little dimpled little thing, and it's the little red thing in the middle of the graph is what you get when you add that signal to this general population of photons. And you see that you couldn't. If the number of photons had been what they calculated in this particular calculation, you could not detect that. And so they didn't detect that at the time. But what's happened over time is that they've watched it, and they've watched the number of photons accumulate. And what happens is that if the Higgs is really there decaying, you get more and more of them all at the same place. And so you start to build up a bump there. And so this is a picture I should have shown you a second ago, showing you the logic of why the photons have the same energy all the time in the rest frame of the thing decaying. And so what they actually saw was they did that plot, and they see the bump there now. They see a bump not at 130 GeV, but they see a bump at 125 GeV. And that tells them that something is decaying into two photons. And it's two photons and not two photons of something else, because if it had been two photons of something else, the photons wouldn't always have the same energy. They distribute energy amongst the three things. Something is decaying into exactly two photons because those two photons always have the same energy in this particular frame where the photons are moving away from each other. So something is being seen that decays into two photons, and because it's decaying into two photons, you know something about its properties. So what do you know? You know that its statistics are that it's a boson like a photon is, because two photons are, they're both bosons, and so it has to be that whatever decays into them is a boson. It has to have a spin that's consistent with the spin of the photons, and if you ask kind of what kinds of spins are allowed to decay into things with two things with spin one, it turns out that it has to be spin zero or spin two. The Higgs would have been spin zero. The graviton would have been spin two, say. Whatever it is has to be electrically neutral because the things that came out, the two photons, were electrically neutral and the charge is conserved. And we know that its mass is 125 GeV because that's where the bump was. So those are the things that have to be true. And those things would all be true for the Higgs particle, but of course the Higgs particle has more properties than just that. So the next thing you ask is, are you looking at the Higgs particle here? So you want to know, is this the Higgs? Or sometimes people talk about a Higgs, and that's because the Higgs is the particle that the Standard Model says should be there. But every theory that we have that's not the Standard Model solves this problem of why the handedness of particles is relevant to the weak interactions in the same kind of a way. They all assign properties to the vacuum, and so although they don't have the same Higgs particle as the Standard Model has, they all have a Higgs particle of some sort. And so the great thing about making waves in the vacuum is that you're learning about the properties of the vacuum when you do it. And so people are asking, is what's being seen consistent with the Higgs particle that the Standard Model predicts, or the Higgs particle that some other theory predicts? And so that's what has been done in the last few years and will be continued to be done for the next few years. So how do you test that? Well, the you remember the Higgs is there because it's the thing that gives you a mass. And so the strength with which you interact with the Higgs particle, with the Higgs field or with the vacuum, is the thing that's telling you how big your mass is, because that's where your mass came from. It was proportional to the strength of your interaction. So if you think of that pictorially and time flowing left to right here, imagine that a particle is moving from left to right. That's this F thing, a fermion. It's interacting with the Higgs field with some strength lambda in that cartoon, and the mass would be proportional to lambda. And the reason that's relevant is that what you actually measure now that you produce the Higgs is you can measure it decaying into things. And so if you just read the same picture where time goes from bottom to top, you can think of this as being the Higgs going along and decaying into two particles, a particle and an antiparticle, F and F bar. And the amplitude for that would be proportional to lambda. And it turns out that means the probability for that is the square of lambda. So you should expect that the Higgs particle decay into things proportional to the mass of the thing it's decaying into. And that means that it's going to like to decay into the heaviest thing it can decay into. It can't decay into something heavier than it is itself, because then energy is not conserved. But it'll decay into anything that's heavier, that's lighter than half its mass. But what that particle is will depend on how heavy the Higgs is. And so until you know what the Higgs mass is, you have to kind of guess what it'll decay into as a function of what its mass is. And so this slide here is showing you what you get in the Standard Model from that. So this is showing you the bottom is the Higgs mass, and then the purple stripe is what its measured value turned out to be. But before people knew that, you can make the plot here. The plot on the vertical axis is the fraction of times the Higgs decays into something. And so and it's a log plot where the top is 1, that means 100% of the time. 10 to the minus 2, or 10 to the minus 1 is 10% of the time, 10 to the minus 2 is 1% of the time. Then the line at the top left is a BB bar. So a Higgs that was 75 GeV, so over the left-hand side of the plot, would almost all the time decay into a BB bar, a bottom quark pair. And then somewhat lower, maybe it's, say, looks like 6 or 7% of the time would decay into tau pairs, then less likely into charm pairs. If you have a much heavier Higgs, it decays into other things. And it turns out that in the interesting range, there's a variety of things it can decay into. And you see that the photons are way down at the bottom there. They're actually, it's a very rare decay of the Higgs, was the one that was seen. It was seen because it's a very clean decay. It's very easy to see they hit the photons, whereas the bottom quarks are actually like dirt in the LHC. They're very hard to see. So all these things you should look for. You should see, you're seeing too. Okay, I can see you. Can you hear me? Are you back? Okay. So they see other things. They see the Higgs decaying into other things besides photons. So the million-dollar question is it doing what the Standard Model says? Cut to the chase, it is. So this plot here is from last, or I guess 2 weeks ago. There was a meeting in Valencia where they summarized all of the information they got in their last, until they shut the LHC down. And what this is showing you across the bottom are different reactions for things you can get in the LHC. And then what you're seeing on the vertical axis is the cross section for it to happen in some units, which are not really important. And then the gray things, which you can sometimes see and sometimes not see, is what the theoretical prediction in the Standard Model would have been. And then the blue things are what they measured when they had the LHC running at the half the energy at 7 TeV. And the orange things are what they measured towards the end when they raised the energy a little bit. And you see that then the reason that there's a bar there is that that range, the vertical range in the blue or the orange things are the errors. And then the vertical thing for the gray prediction is also the theoretical error. And you see that essentially they're all consistent. There's three or four things that the Higgs could have decayed into, like two tau particles or two W particles or two Z particles and a Z and W. There's no Z and W. But all the ones that they could have seen, they have been seeing, and they're seeing them at a rate which is consistent with what the Standard Model says they should be seeing. So the short version is that it looks like a duck, it smells like a duck, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. So it's probably a duck, but it may not be the duck you think it is. So what does it mean? So I'm going to wrap up with this. This is now a scorecard, cartoon scorecard for what the fact that the Higgs looks very simple mean for the various theories that have been proposed to replace the Standard Model. And I'm going to be completely biased here and tell you that they all suck except for the one I think is right. So one theory was that the Higgs was actually a composite made of smaller things. This is like the historically the conservative thing, that normally you find that things you see that you thought were elementary are actually made of smaller things. And the Higgs could have been like that. And that turns out to be a bad description of what they see. If that were true, you would not expect to be able to see things like the Higgs decaying into photons and into things like W's and Z particles. And so the fact that you see them all at the Standard Model level is actually hard to explain in this kind of a theory. So they all are kind of down in the mouth when you go to meetings. They put on a brave face, but they're basically down in the mouth. Then the thing you probably heard about the most is what most people thought was going to be seen was supersymmetry, that every particle in the Standard Model has a partner with a different spin, and they all have specific kinds of properties. And that turns out to be also not a very good description of what's seen, because it was expected in that theory that the Higgs would be quite light. And the heavier it gets, the harder it is to understand as being supersymmetric. And 125 is just on the edge. You can kind of just make it work, but people don't like it too much because it's kind of on the boundary. When you see the movie Particle Fever later on, you'll hear them talk about the tension between supersymmetry and other theories. And that's more or less the problem, that the Higgs should have been lighter if supersymmetry had been true. The other thing they talk about is the multiverse, it's a great movie, don't get me wrong, but it's that particular dichotomy they put up is not really, I think, the thing to worry about, but it's a really good movie. I think you'll enjoy it. So supersymmetry, the joke of supersymmetry is that the supersymmetric partner of the top quark is called the stop, and the only stop that's been seen at CERN is the stop sign here at the gate. So that's they're all down the mouth too. But the thing that has not been ruled out yet is if the third proposal that was on the table was that there are extra dimensions, and because of that, gravity is becoming important at the Large Hadron Collider. That hasn't been decisively tested, so there's no evidence that this is what's happening. But if this is what's happening, then you would have expected the Higgs to be actually the Standard Model Higgs, and you would not have expected yet to see any evidence for the extra dimensions because their energies have not been high enough yet. So this is the one to watch when they turn it on at the 14 TeV in the spring, because if this is what's right, and this is the one that's smelling the best so far, I would say, then this is the one that you should start to see evidence for when they start the LHC again at their full energy. So the bottom line is, the LHC has been 20 years in coming, and I've been waiting that 20 years, and it's now been running for a couple of years, and it's been shut off again while they fix it, but it's already provided new information about how we think about what the Standard Model's alternatives are. They found one thing so far. Actually, I say that wrong. The experimentalists always cringe when you say that they failed to find things like supersymmetry. They found nothing, as opposed to they haven't found anything. And for them, it's the absence of something rather than not doing a good job looking. So what they have found was something that was expected. It's a Higgs. It looks like a Higgs particle. It's got all the properties of the Higgs particle. It has a mass, which is kind of an interesting mass in that it's not easy to explain in all the various theories that replace the standard model, but the standard model can live with it. It's something which is not a bad mass for the standard model. It means that although it's boring if you're a theorist, it means that this Higgs mechanism is right. It was a very radical proposal that was made in the 60s, for which, and we've been out on a theoretical limb for 40 years since the 60s, or 50 years now, where we've believed that the vacuum has physical properties, but we've never had the acid test by making a wave in the vacuum to verify that it has properties. That test has been done now for 2 years, and we know now the vacuum has properties. And that's a remarkable statement. Although it's a boring one if you thought that it was true 50 years ago, which all theorists did, but it's still fundamentally important that it's been tested experimentally. And the big thing is to watch for the surprises, because that's the thing that is always where you learn the most. And I think what you're going to see is extra dimensions showing up at the LHC, but hopefully it'll be something that no one's expecting. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for that excellent talk. We'll take some questions now. What we'll do, if you can raise your hand, we'll get you to speak in this microphone just so that it can be heard very clearly. Tanya will come around to you and take your questions. Just raise your hand.
So what led to the belief that these black holes were going to be created and ultimately devour all the Earth and everything we know?
Oh, yeah, good question. And before I answer, you know, you should there's two things you should Google. One is the LHC destroying the Earth? Because there's a lot of really cool websites where they have movies of the Earth being destroyed by the LHC. And they've all got a driving soundtrack. It's actually really cool. And it eats Switzerland, and it eats France, and it eats. And they have a whole bunch of details right. That they, you know, the beam first goes in, and it goes around the loop, and it actually first would intersect on the CMS side of the ring, and that's where the black hole starts to eat the Earth. So they get a lot of things right. And there's also a website called one by the CERN people, which I used to have on my slides here, which unfortunately I probably don't have anymore. But anyway, if you Google "did the LHC destroy the Earth," there's a CERN page which, if you pull it up, there's a big one word on it that says no, period. But then there's, if you look in the source code of that page, it says if the Earth does get eaten by the LHC, please contact so and so because we'll up. So it shows you that there's two people of the CERN and the other people. There's some of them have more time on their hands than others do, so they have much nicer web pages. So it's a picture where the dimensions are large that I think is actually going to be true, is the one that says that black holes should be produced, because if dimensions are large, what happens is that the force line. If you imagine that how strong gravity would feel, one way to think about that is that if you imagine force lines radiating out from a particle, the number of lines that you intercept would be the strength of the force, and then so somehow the fact that forces fall off like an inverse square law, like in the Coulomb law or Newton's law, one way to think of that is that if you drew a sphere around a point source, it intercepts a whole bunch of force lines, and it always intercepts the same number of lines because the lines are all the only end at the charge, and so the amount of force the force lines or field lines you intercept in any one sphere will always be the same size, but because the area of a sphere goes like r squared, the intensity of the force has to go like 1 over r squared, so that the total flux of force is the same, no matter how big the sphere is. That might have been an opaque way to say that the farther away you get from a charge, the weaker the force is. But the inverse square law is specific for 3 dimensions. If you had been in 5 dimensions, it would be an inverse to the 4th power law. And if you'd been in 9 dimensions, it would have been inverse to the, you know, add one more dimension for each. You know, it's 1 over the number of dimensions plus 2, or minus 2, sorry, minus 1 if it's space dimensions. I'll get it right eventually. So the main thing is, if there are more dimensions than the ones we see, then gravity is kind of getting weaker with separation in those extra dimensions as well as the ones we see. And so it's going to appear to us to be weaker than we would have thought if there had only been three dimensions, because it's been diluted by having to go into the other dimensions. And so that means that, conversely, since we measure gravity in four dimensions, gravity must really be stronger in the extra dimensions if the extra dimensions are being there. And so it turns out that gravity is strong enough, if there are extra dimensions big enough to be seen, it would be actually, quantum gravity would be important at the energies available at the LHC. And so that's why they expect that black holes would be produced. So the expectation that black holes could be produced is actually true. People do expect them to be produced if you believe that these theories are right. But the reason that people are not worried about that is that the black holes, once you produce them, the first thing they do is they evaporate. The cartoon of a black hole is that it sits there and it just sucks everything in like a vacuum cleaner. And that's not the way black holes work. Black holes are once you make them, classically, it's like anything else. It's a black hole whose mass is the sun is like the sun as far as gravity is concerned. So if we replace the sun by a black hole with the same mass, it would be dark. But we would otherwise, our orbits wouldn't change at all as we go around the sun. It's not like we don't get sucked into the sun. And so, but that's a classical statement. At the quantum level, what happens is that the black holes radiate, and that's normally completely negligible for astrophysical black holes. But if it's small enough to be produced at the LHC, it's actually a very, very small black hole. And for that, quantum effects are enormous. And so the dominant thing is that it explodes. And so it would just be a source of more particles like we're already getting from the LHC. So there's no danger of the black hole doing anything nasty to us. But the reason that they're there, expected to be there, is that gravity is expected to be strong if it's true that there are extra dimensions that are big enough to be seen.
Okay, next question.
If you don't mind to go back to, I think it's 82 or 83, the slide with the
probability of various events.
I didn't mean for you to see the number of slides because that normally depresses people.
This one. Now, you said that the Higgs is more likely to come from a photon-photon interaction, 10 to the minus 3. Now, after how many events do you actually see this? I'm thinking more practically. You have to run the LHC all year long? Or how many events must happen in order to see that little bump?
So that's we can see that from here.
Yes.
So they have... So you can see that the basic curve here at the mass of the Higgs was something like 800 to, I guess, 700 or something like that, 700 to 800. And this is events in an energy window of about 1.6 GeV. So if you kind of take if you took a little histogram at the Higgs mass, roughly, of 1.0 GeV wide, they were getting in the ballpark of 800 events there. And you can kind of see that the excess that was in the Higgs was just the difference between the yellow line and the top of that bin. So that's like maybe 100 or so events. So they ran for several years, and they accumulated this many number of events of two photon events of various types. That's the yellow line. And then they had a small excess of Higgs particles. So that's the difference between the yellow line and the red line. And if you kind of could count all the difference between the red line and the yellow line, and shade that in, the area of that would be the total number of events I saw. So it's in the ballpark of several hundred events, it looks like. Maybe a couple thousand events. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
One thing I should clarify is that in this picture, I was not trying to say that the two photon events are actually very common. You can see from this picture that the most likely thing for a Higgs to decay into is two bottom quarks. And then after that is two W quarks, working my way down from top to bottom in the pink line. And then after that is, it looks like, what is that? It's two gluons. And then after that is two tau particles. And then down there is a tie between two charm particles and two Z particles. And then way down at the bottom is two photons, and then below that is a photon and a Z. And so it was actually a very rare, it's very unlikely. If they saw 1,000 photon events, probably they were seeing something like a million Higgs being produced, and they were just not seeing the other ones because they were not producing two photons. So it's a very unlikely event, the two photon one. It's just that it's a very easy one to detect because the photons are easy to detect.
How concerned are you guys with that 5 GeV difference? Because you're looking for 130 GeV Higgs and you found 125 GeV Higgs.
Well, that 130 wasn't a prediction. That was, where was that? That's, you're thinking this 130. What they did before they found the Higgs is they did everything. They said that anywhere from about, they knew that it couldn't be heavy, lighter than 115 because they would have then been seen in earlier accelerators. But anything above 115 to about 250, it could have been anywhere. So they would repeat this kind of a plot for all different masses between 115 to 124. Because there was no prediction for in the standard model, the Higgs parameter, Higgs mass is just a parameter. And you could dial it to be pretty much anything you want, up to about 200 or 240 GeV. And after that, it becomes kind of hard to reconcile with other things. So this plot, I think they just took as an example 130 GeV, but there was no reason why they chose that rather than some other number.
Any more questions? Well, if not, I have one question. I just have a quick question. You mentioned a few times that you, in terms of possibilities, you are kind of betting on or think that there'll be large extra dimensions seeing evidence for. Just wondering if you could say more about that, why you think that, what we might look for, and just anything more on that topic.
Okay. I think that one of the big puzzles that the standard model has, and in fact, all theories that replace the standard model also have, is what's called the cosmological constant problem. The problem basically is that we think all the theories we have predict that the vacuum should have not only physical properties, but it should have an energy density. And we can calculate what it is. It's actually quite large. It's kind of in the ballpark of the mass. A particle of mass m contributes something proportional to the mass to the fourth power to the vacuum energy, and you have to sum that up over all the particles that we know about, and you see that there's about 20 or so particles in the standard model, and they all contribute, the heavier ones contribute more than the lighter ones do. But the vacuum energy, normally in particle physics, you don't care about the vacuum energy because all you measure are energy differences because the vacuum energy is something which is always there, and you're always looking at how the energy changes, and the vacuum isn't changing. But if the vacuum has energy, it will gravitate. And so the thing is that you can measure the vacuum energy in cosmology because it changes the way the universe expands. And the best theory for dark energy, those two things that were, we knew the standard model was wrong because there's dark matter and dark energy, and most of what's out there is dark energy. And the dark energy differs from the dark matter in that dark matter is something which is seen to gravitate like ordinary particles gravitate in galaxies and clusters of galaxies. The evidence for dark matter is that there's a lot of stuff gravitating there in an ordinary way, which we're not seeing. But dark energy is known to be different because something is making the universal expansion accelerate, so it's expanding faster and faster rather than decelerate. And that's an unusual thing because in order to make the universal expansion, normally what would happen with gravity is because gravity is always attractive, all the galaxies are pulling on one another, so they should all be slowing each other down, and so the universal expansion should always be decelerating. But it's turned out to be accelerating, and so it's as if something is repelling under gravity. And it turns out the vacuum energy would do that. The vacuum has a negative pressure, it turns out, and that would make it's the way you'd tell that it's gravitating is that would the vacuum would tend to make the universe. If the dominant energy in the universe is the vacuum energy, it would tend to make the universe accelerate in its expansion. And so the simplest description of dark energy is that it is the vacuum energy. And the only thing wrong with that description is that the measured amount of energy that they're seeing is 10 to the 50 times smaller than the energy that we think the vacuum should have when we calculate it. And so that mismatch, sometimes you hear it's 10 to the 120, and that's just because if you imagine that you had some physics at the Planck scale, that's what the answer would be. But we don't know of any particles that are heavier than the top quark, the top quark is the heaviest one we know about. And so if you just take the standard model, you're off by 50-something orders of magnitude. So most people will tell you that there's no solution to that problem. It's not like there's a lot of theoretical ways you could evade the problem of why the vacuum energy seems not to be gravitating. And that's unusual. Normally, theorists will make up a new theory that solves the problem, and then the experimentalists have to choose which one's right. And so the party line, if you ask most people, would be there's no solution to the cosmological constant problem. There's no known theory which can make the vacuum energy not gravitate. But I think that that's actually wrong. I think that we've actually found a solution. And it relies on extra dimensions. And it relies on extra dimensions being large enough to be seen at the LHC. And the idea basically is that we know that the vacuum energy is very symmetric because the vacuum is very symmetric. And Einstein tells us that energy has to curve space-time, but if there's more than four dimensions, it doesn't have to curve the dimensions you're looking at in cosmology. It can be curving the extra dimensions. And so the, more or less that's the loophole you're looking through. But in order to get the size of the dark energy right, the extra dimensions have to be as big as they can possibly be without being seen already, which in itself didn't have to be possible. It could have been true that the dark energy was inconsistent with measurements of extra dimensions, but it turns out that they are consistent. But if the extra dimensions are as big as they need to be to solve the cosmological constant problem, they will be there for the LHC to find. And so I think that the cosmological constant problem is telling us that the extra dimensions have to be big enough, have to be there and big enough to be seen at the LHC. And I think the reason that most people don't make that argument is that most of them don't appreciate that there's a solution to the cosmological constant problem in extra dimensions. So I've got bets with people. I've got bets. Normally I take odds on that bet because most people think I'm wrong. So I bet a bottle of wine if I lose a bottle of wine if it turns out that I'm wrong and there are no extra dimensions, but I get a case of wine if I'm right. And so, and I'm giving away a Niagara wine if I lose, and I'm betting people in Italy and France and in Cambridge and places that have very nice wine regions, so that the cases I expect to get will be very nice.
Thank you for that. Good luck with the bets. Are there any more? Any more questions? Yes.
If your bet is right and there are extra dimensions, what would you see in the detectors, or what would you expect to see?
That's a great question, and it's hard to be completely unambiguous about it because the part of the theory hasn't been fleshed out yet. But I think two things have to be there. One of them is at the LHC specifically, they should see missing energy because you can lose energy into the extra dimensions and then you don't see it. But more important than that is that quantum gravity is really going to be important at the LHC energies. And so that means you have to know what quantum gravity is. And so we don't have a lot of options as to what quantum gravity is. But one option is concrete enough that you can actually think about what the predictions might be, and that's string theory. And so in string theory, what would happen is that the... string theory, what happens is that all the particles we see are actually really vibrating strings. And so that means that if you take a particle like a W boson, you should be able to pluck that string and make it vibrate even faster, and then that'll look like a different particle with the same properties but more massive. So there should be copies of all the particles we see, but that are heavier than the ordinary particles we know about. But they should decay into the things that ordinary particles already are known to decay into, and so they should be very easy to see if they're there. So I think that's the thing that they'll see. They'll see an excited Z particle or excited W particle or excited gluon or something. And they are looking for that because other theories also predict that. But the thing that will really be the smoking gun will be Newton's law has to change from an inverse square law to an inverse fourth power law at a distance of about a micron. And it's been tested down to about 40 microns. And so I think what will happen is that they'll see interesting things at the LHC, and they'll also see Newton's law change. And if you see all that happening together, it'll be hard to get wrong that that was extra dimensions turning on. So if that's what happens, I'll come back and remind you all that you heard it here first.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions that people have for Cliff? I guess I just have one more. We've got five more minutes. If I was talking to students, I was talking to grade 11, grade 12 physics students, and there was one thing I should kind of convey to them about just with the switch on of the LHC at full energy and its significance and what it means and what to look out for. What kind of one or two points would you kind of emphasize?
And what should they hope should happen, or what they think will happen?
No, in terms of what should they know about to really appreciate or have some context to it or understand it or.
Well, I think this is like opening the wardrobe towards Narnia. There could be anything behind that door, and it's kind of been disappointing that every time a door has been opened for the last 20 years or so, it's just clothes. we're hoping that this next time we open it, there's going to be a whole new world, and we're going to see the first part of it. And so the context is that really there's been a long, for experimentalists, it's been great because there's been a lot of very precise predictions to test, and they've been testing them very carefully. But for theorists, it's been kind of dull because the theory that's working really well was made up a long time ago, and we want to make up a new one. And we know that we do need to make up a new one because neutrinos are behaving wrong and dark energy, dark matter is wrong. So there's something wrong, but there's nothing concrete yet in the LHC, which should be the thing that tells us exactly what's wrong. And there's lots of ways you can get dark energy, dark matter to try and work. Dark energy is harder, maybe. Neutrinos you can kind of make models about, but there's nothing really decisive about it yet. Whereas the LHC, if it can actually identify by producing new particles explicitly in your face that you can then measure their properties, should be telling us what the thing is that's replacing the standard model, which we know has to be there. It's just a question of what it is. And it's exasperating that it's taking so long to figure out what it is because there's so few experimental clues. Which I would add is exactly what extra dimensions would make it look like.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time. It's been an excellent presentation.